So my pleasure to introduce Professor Verbit. He's a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College, and he's it's a pleasure to hear him speak to us tonight on a very important and interesting topic of the shift to the right.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here, and especially to have the opportunity to meet some of you again in a different setting and in a different era. Whenever someone comes to hear something that I have to say after they've already heard, I get a little worried. They tell the story of a performance of an opera in Italy, where they really know their opera. And after the tenor's main aria, they called for an encore, so we sang it again. And they called for a second encore. They wouldn't let the performance continue, so we sang it a third time. They called for a third encore. At this point, the soprano, who was standing off by the side, got very nervous, very jittery. And she came to the audience and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I don't understand this. We're all singing our hearts out for you. We're all trying to give you a good performance. How come it's only my colleague, the tenor, that is asked to sing encore after encore?" And someone stood up in the fifth row and answered, "He's going to sing it until he gets it right." So, a generation and a half ago, nobody would have expected this evening's subject to be before us. In fact, exactly the opposite was predicted. It was assumed that serious, committed, traditional forms of religion, already on the fringe, would move even closer to the edge, would continue to be the plaything of older folks, and that the younger generation would become more and more acclimated to a larger American culture as serious traditional Orthodox religion became narrower. So much so that the leading sociologist of the Jews, in fact the man who invented the field and was very good at it, referred to the institutional decline, referred to Orthodoxy as a study in institutional decline. And that's what everybody believed. Well, obviously in the generation and a half since then, it hasn't worked out that way. The old pictures of synagogue dinners that show women in sleeveless dresses are removed from the walls. There are now sleeves, and men who did not wear kippot in public now do wear kippot in public, and women cover their hair, and more people are learning, and more of the kids are going to day schools. More are entering careers only for the sake of getting parnassah when they really want to sit and learn all day. The whole dating system has changed, and the shidduch system been introduced. In so many, many ways, the community clearly has moved to the right. What does the right mean? I mean, right and left are hard enough to define in politics. How does one define right, the right in religion? Probably it means the degree to which the options are reduced. The fewer the options from which it's legitimate to choose, the more to the right we are. The more elbow room, the more freedom to choose among a wider range of options, the more to the left we are. In other words, the move to the right means the introduction of additional chumrot, because that's really what a chumra is. If you want to know what's the machmir position and what's the mekel position, the simple question to ask is, which gives you more options? The one that gives you more options is the mekel position. The one that gives you fewer options is the machmir position. Now, what happened? There are a number of explanations that are often given in the literature. One, of course, if you're familiar with this, is the movement from the Rav to the Rosh Yeshiva as the leader, as the religious leader of the community. That it used to be that the Rav of the community, involved with the practicalities and the realities of everyday life, was seen as the religious authority. Increasingly, the Rosh Yeshiva, who doesn't have to deal with concrete issues, but instead can derive his understanding and his learning from the literature alone, comes to replace the Rabbanim as the religious arbiters. And since they are less in a position to moderate the text with the real issues of life, the text tends to get applied more strictly. There's a second kind of explanation that's often given, that has to do with publication. That one of the reasons we no longer look as much to the Rav is all the halachic codes that are published. It's available to everybody. one can look it up and see it in its strictest possible form. As has been quipped, we used to ask our rabbanim what books are worth reading. Now we ask Art Scroll whether a rabbi is worth listening to. And that publication and codification of all of the guides has introduced a drive to the right. I'll tell you why it's not enough of an answer. It's true that religious authority has shifted from the Rav to the Rosh Yeshiva. It's also true that more people have more access to halachic guidebooks than ever used to be the case. But why does that drive us to the right? It was not always so. In the arguments between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, Beit Hillel was almost always decisive. And as the rabbis tell us, Beit Hillel tended to be mekil. Beit Shammai tended to be machmir. So in the age of Hillel and Shammai, it was the mekil authority who more often prevailed. The fact that someone is an authority doesn't mean that he has to be more machmir. The Rambam spoke of the golden mean, saying sometimes you come with a chumrah, sometimes you come with a kula, sometimes you're strict, sometimes you're lenient. What he meant by the golden mean is not that you come down the middle every time, but you have to decide. You don't always be lenient, you don't always be strict, you have to use judgment. And there was the old Yiddish expression that used to say any Amaretz can be machmir. It takes a real Talmid Chacham to be mekil, which was what the way of saying that chumrah is often the easy way out when you don't know better. Now, given all of those historical precedents, it's not enough of an explanation to say that the reason for the movement to the right is the shift from the Rav to the Rosh Yeshiva, or the publication of Art Scroll and other such guides. Because the Rosh Yeshiva could be Mekilim, and the guides could give more lenient interpretations. These are simply the vehicles through which the move to the right is being conveyed and implemented. So we still have the question. Part of the answer is outside the Jewish community, because it's a general trend. Part of the answer is inside the Jewish community. What I'd like to do is suggest a number of the reasons that come together. There's no one reason, of course. In social history, there's never only one reason. Several things have to come together to congeal and to make a trend. First, secularization isn't what it used to be. In the world generally, the last 300-400 years, it was assumed that everything would get more secular, that religion would become increasingly narrow. A generation and a half, 2 generations ago, people who were very genuinely and seriously religious were seen as sort of offbeat. I mean, they were fanatics, of which it's okay, you know, to have a few. Where they were clergymen, where they were older people. The psychologists explained that they were cramming for finals. But it was narrow. It wasn't in the center of culture. It was assumed that the world was going to become increasingly secular. It did not happen. It didn't happen in part because of a number of ideological changes. Some of you have heard me say this before. Forgive me, it's also relevant tonight. A number of changes occurred. It used to be believed by moderns that there was going to be progress in everything. We were living in this day and age, in a modern world. We were standing on the shoulders of giants. We knew more than our ancestors because we had learned what they had discovered, and we could see further. It was believed that there was a kind of evolution in morality and in human understanding as well. Humanity was getting better. We weren't barbarians anymore. Well, it's not true. The last several decades have demonstrated that. When a second Holocaust was threatened, the world didn't cry out. When Nasser said in 67, May of 67, we're going to push them into the sea, the world didn't cry out. And of course he didn't succeed. But Cambodia, Biafra, the Yibo, Rwanda, Darfur, people slaughtered in hundreds of thousands all over the place. And we wink and go about our business. Remember Kitty Genovese in Queens? When she was killed by a guy who came back 3 times till he finally killed her, it was witnessed by 38 people from their apartment windows, the police found out. Nobody came to save her. We don't believe in progress anymore. We know better. We can be just as inhumane as they used to be in the old days. That's a change. Because no religion believes in progress. The modern person believes in progress. Religions believe that principles are eternal. We don't necessarily learn better. We do better, we do worse, but the principles are eternal. Or worse than that, the golden age was way back then and we've been sliding ever since. The modern perspective, the secular perspective, believed that what mattered was being pragmatic, being able to get things done. Doesn't matter what you're doing, getting things done. For religion, what you're doing, what you're accomplishing, what the goal is of utmost importance. And postmoderns are beginning to understand that you can't just be pragmatic. Being effective isn't what matters. Knowing what you're being effective at is more important, because there are consequences in any case. In a number of ways like that, the secular perspective seems to be failing. It doesn't provide a context in which we can have values or meanings that go beyond culture, that go beyond ourselves, that go beyond our own histories. And so the desire to have those things return people to the possibility of reviewing what religion deals with. Because at its very heart, these are the things religions deal with. Here's another factor. It's not only that the philosophy of secularism has changed, its quality, its nature has changed. I used to quip that when you walk down the street in Yerushalayim on Shabbat afternoon, you could always tell which houses were religious and which houses were secular. Because out of the religious houses, you heard smirot being sung, and from the windows of the secular houses, you heard recording of Mozart being played. What secularism used to mean was secular humanism, an attempt to establish a philosophy of ethics and morality without referring to God. The attempt to mobilize people to do social justice for its own sake, to care for one another because it's the nice thing to do, to create art and literature at the highest level. That's what secularism used to mean. What has secular culture come to mean now? Hedonism. Whatever makes you feel good. Get as rich as fast and as much as you can, no matter what you have to do to other people to get there. Self-indulgence. Do what makes you feel good. I mean, look at the arts around us. Are there any Shakespeare's? Are there any Mozart's? The leaders of secular life, are they worried about morality and philosophy? Or is it a question of, you know, how can we exploit people better so that we can get richer? Put bluntly. Is it an attempt to build family life with or without a philosophical, theological underpinning? Or is it, let's do whatever makes us feel good, because feeling good is what it's all about? Look at all 179 channels you can tune into. It's junk. It's all wall-to-wall junk. That is to say, secular culture, and the West says so. We say so ourselves. So, from the other side of the fence, when religion looks at that, the conversation is a different conversation. What serious religion used to be able to say is, these people aren't believers, and they're wrong for not being believers. But they're decent people. They worry about one another. They're trying to establish ethics without God. It's going to fail, but at least they're trying to establish ethics. Look at the art they're producing. It's not religious art, but look at the art. Now, what is produced, what is considered, the values at the base of it, It's gimme, 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 get me, get me, get me, let's shop, let's shop, let's shop, let's buy more and more and more. And you know, how do they say it? The guy with most toys is the winner. If that's secular culture, then when religion looks over the fence, it looks not simply at something that is respectable, but unfortunately theologically wrong. It looks at something that it really wants to resist, that it really wants to remove itself from in a far more serious and important way. Freedom is a value, but freedom itself has changed its meaning. When we say freedom these days, what we tend to mean is a lack of constraint. Do what you want, freedom. It's Erev Pesach. I've always been intrigued by two words that crop up in around Pesach. You know, Pesach is before and after. First we were in Egypt and then we got out. When we were in Egypt, what were we?
Slaves.
Give me the Hebrew sentence. Avadinu hayinu l'faro b'mitzrayim. Okay. Now when God says to Moshe, go and get him out, what does he say? That the message is supposed to be to Paro. Shalach et ami v'yavduni. So before is avadim hayinu l'faro b'mitzrayim. After it's the Ya'avdun. It's the same word. It's the same word. Ayin vet dalet. Eved. The difference is, before we were avadim lefaro b'mitzrayim. We served the human king. We weren't free to do what was inherent, what was generic, what was really us. We were limited in that way. After we got freedom, we could be avadim l'Hashem, to God, which is, of course, the ultimate freedom in Jewish terms. So it isn't a matter of lack of constraint. You don't tell me what to do. I can do whatever I want at the moment. Freedom was the ability to be what inherently we most basically and honestly were. But that, too, requires some restraint. That conception of freedom is not part of contemporary secular culture. The conception of freedom in contemporary secular culture is no limitation, whatever I feel at the moment. From the other side of the line, from the religious side of the line, therefore the attitude is going to be different. The conversation will be shorter and will be more distant, because there will be less to talk about between religion and secular culture, and the resistance to it will be greater. You see, every religion that disagrees with what's going on around it has to make a choice about how high and thick to build the walls around itself. To what extent and in what ways should it participate with the surrounding culture? When the surrounding culture is theologically wrong but respectable, made up of people who are concerned with their ethics of human relationship, with an attempt to do social justice in the world, to be artistically accomplished and sensitive. Well, they may not believe the right things, but there's a basis for conversation. When the people on the other side of the line in the secular world are headed for what is contemporary terms idolatrous, not just not believing, just morally debased, no concern for humanity, for justice, for art, for expression, then you're more eager to keep your own inside. You want the walls higher, there's less to talk about, and the risk is greater. Because if you lose someone, you lose them not to a nice way of life, philosophically wrong. You lose them to a debased way of life. To a world that is not just flawed, but really bad. So as secular culture declines, the walls that serious religion builds around itself inevitably become higher and thicker. And you get things like, don't watch TV, don't read newspapers, don't go on the net, don't go to universities. Because universities aren't simply places anymore where no one learns philosophy and lives a nice life. Universities are places where the students, and most of them, do whatever they feel like at any given moment, with the university's blessing. No standards, no particular patterns of interrelationship that parents would like to see. That is, even the good part of it gets tangled up in the part of it that we want to avoid. And the walls get higher and the walls get thicker. That's happening not only among Jews. It's happening among traditional and committed Christians and Muslims and Hindus and all groups when they look at the secular world. It is worse than it used to be from a religious point of view, and therefore the defenses around it tend to become greater. Now, there's some additional aspects in the Jewish community. By way of preface, I have to say something about the other movements, the non-Orthodox movements. Because Orthodoxy, I would argue, is still seen by most Jews still as most authentic. Not if you ask them outright. Not if you ask them outright. Studies have been done. You know, is Orthodoxy more authentic than your movement? And of course they all say no. Is your movement just as authentic as all the others? And of course they all say yes. I'll tell you how I found out it's not true. I asked the question differently in a study I did of university students in the mid-70s, again in the mid-80s. I don't have more recent data, but those data were interesting. Instead of saying, is your movement as authentic, I found out what movement they were raised in. And then I gave them a little grid. You know, how appropriate is each of these terms as a description of each of those movements? Orthodox, conservative, reform, Hasidic, by which they understood Haredi. If I said Haredi, they wouldn't have known what I was talking about. Hasidic, they don't make the distinction, most students, between Hasidic and Lithuanian. For them, it really meant Haredi. And then I gave a series of words. And for each word, for each movement, they had to check that it was very appropriate, somewhat appropriate, or inappropriate. One of those words was authentic. So they had to circle very appropriate, somewhat appropriate, inappropriate. Across the board, no matter what their upbringing, they all rated Orthodoxy more authentic than the other movements, including their own. So when you ask them outright, of course they're going to claim authenticity. They've been told to. It's a big issue in the other movements. But when you hide the issue in a series of questions, which as any research social scientist will tell you you have to do if you want people to tell you the truth, they then tell you what they really think. And there is that sense, again, I think not only among Jews, but generally that authentic religion is the more traditional religion. Now, obviously the liberal movements at their best do not think that. If you read conservative philosophy, reform philosophy, they will explain to you why their approach is in fact the continuation of rabbinic Judaism. And why orthodoxy sort of congealed and left the true rabbinic pattern that went through the Talmudic period and the Gaonic period and so on. That's what their scholars and their leaders will say, what their thinkers genuinely believe. But the movements, the people, are made up not only of the scholars and the thinkers and the philosophers, but people. And any movement attracts to it people for a variety of reasons. We call that in sociology mixed motivation. The fact that any organization, any movement, will attract to it people for a variety of reasons. There's a quip about Orthodox, conservative, and reform that I'll come to in a minute, but before I, you know, there are many quips about, you know, what the differences are. First I'll tell you my favorite one, then I'll tell you the one I need tonight. My favorite one, you might have heard it, grows out of a psak that was issued on smoking. When they found how dangerous smoking can be to your health, a great rav issued a psak that smoking is forbidden by Jewish law because it endangers your health. Finished. So, of course, each movement had to respond. The spokesman for the Reform movement announced that since the Reform movement does not consider itself bound by halacha, the Reform rabbis at their recent convention passed a resolution that smoking is good for your health. Spokesman for the conservative movement announced that halacha, of course, is binding, and therefore they expect their rabbis to stop smoking. In the spirit of Elu Ve'elu, if somebody really wants to smoke, that's also probably okay as a minority position. And a spokesman for Orthodoxy announced that since this psak has been issued, there's, you know, in the future no further question, and therefore any Orthodox Jew who wants to smoke first has to sell his lungs to a non-Jew. I have learned, by the way, that, footnote, I have learned, by the way, there are two kinds of people to whom you can tell that joke. Those who laugh at all of it and those who laugh at two-thirds of it. The ones who laugh at two-thirds of it are dangerous people. They really are. Anyhow, that's not the one I want to use. The one I want to use is it's also been said that Orthodox Jews are crazy, conservative Jews are hazy, and Reform Jews are lazy. Now that's part of the truth. Let's start with Reform. It's safer in this building. There are some people who are part of the Reform movement because as they understand Jewish history, Jewish thought, having thought it through, having sort of felt their way to a position on what God really wants of humanity and of the Jewish people, they've come to the conclusion that the Reform interpretation, philosophically, is the best one. It's the one that's most on the mark. But then there are also Jews who are lazy about their Jewishness. I mean, they want to dip in every now and then, you know, sort of dip a toe in the water from time to time, not be bothered too much, not be made to feel guilty too much, just come and go as they like, you know, a little bit. Which movement will they feel most comfortable in? The Reform movement. Now, in the conservative movement, there are some people who are there because as they understand Jewish history, as they think through what God wants of the Jewish people, as they really read the texts and understand and discuss, they come to the conclusion that the conservative understanding of the whole tradition and the Mesorah is the conservative approach. And so they're there. But then there are those Jews who, you know, they don't want to have to think these things through too much. You know, you're right, and he's right, and she right, she's right, and isn't it nice that we're all right, and, you know, the doctrine doesn't matter that much anyhow, you know, let's all be nice together. They will feel best in a conservative shul. And, of course, in Orthodoxy, there are those who, having thought it through and having studied the text, come to the conclusion that the Orthodox understanding of halacha and the Brit at Sinai, so that the Orthodox interpretation is really the one that's right. And so that's why they're in Orthodoxy. And then there are the compulsive neurotics, who simply never want to think. They want to be told and finished, and they want to be sure that it's, or the triumphalists, the ones who want to feel more pious than the next guy, they will probably have their happiest home in Orthodoxy. Now you say, but that's not what really Orthodoxy is. Of course not. Assimilation isn't what Reform really is. And sort of wishy-washiness isn't what conservatism is. But the Jews who are half assimilating and on their way out will be found in the Reform temples because that's where they'll be most comfortable. And the wishy-washy ones who don't want to think about it much at all, they don't want to be too much this way, they don't want to be too much that way, they want to cover all fronts, they're going to be most at home in conservative synagogues, though that's not conservative Judaism. And the compulsive neurotics and triumphalists will feel most comfortable, and we're likely to find them in Orthodox shuls, even though obviously that isn't what Orthodoxy is about. So any movement will attract, as long as the door is open, any movement will attract to it people for a variety of reasons. Now what that means is, when you look at the movement, I mean, let's look at the people who are there for the wrong reasons. When you look at the people who are there for the wrong reasons in Orthodoxy, you see people who feel they are right, and who need that feeling psychologically, and people who, you know, stick to it. Well, you know, that's sort of a consistency and a sense of rightness. When you look at the conservative movement and you look at the extrinsic people, it's a kind of wishy-washiness. That's not what religion is about. And when you look at the Reform temple, the people who are there for the wrong reasons, the extrinsic reasons, are there because they sort of have one foot out the door. And that's not what it's about. So they have to look less authentic, just when you look at the groups. They look less authentic. And in part they are, because the people who are, you know, sort of hanging on a little bit, but who aren't really committed in a religious mode, are more likely to be in the more liberal places. So you put all of that together, one can understand, in part, why everybody looks at Orthodoxy as more authentic, even beyond the philosophical arguments that I think one can make up to establish that. Now, within Orthodoxy, within Orthodox circles, I think you find essentially three kinds of people. There are the Haredim. There are those who are modern but committed to halacha. I mean, they will do what the halacha says, as it is explained and as it is understood, but they also feel it's legitimate to study secular culture, to participate in the outside world, to do those things that people do that are not explicitly forbidden in terms of dress, in terms of recreational activities, in terms of all sorts of things. Because unless there's a halachic injunction against it, it's considered legitimate. They feel more than that, that it's appropriate to participate in the larger culture to the extent that Jewish law allows it. The Haredim, of course, believe the less you participate in the culture around you, the better off you are. And that should be dramatically expressed in a whole host of ways in terms of style of dress, enclosed communities, enclosed social relationships, and so on. The third group in Orthodoxy are the people who are there just because they like the traditional style. It's not really out of a commitment to halacha or to a Jewish understanding that makes halacha divine and binding. It's that when they stop off and do their Jewish thing, they like a traditional style. They're also part of Orthodoxy. They are likely to be, of course, part of the left wing of Orthodoxy, which means, statistically speaking, the left wing of Orthodoxy will have a greater admixture of people who aren't really committed than will the right wing of Orthodoxy. And so when we look at the two approaches, the right wing will look more pure, will look more enthusiastic, will look more committed. Simply because a higher proportion of the people in that wing, in fact, are, only because the Haredi wing does not attract the people who are there for the extrinsic kinds of reasons. That, by the way, is changing. The people who were in Orthodox, by the way, the numbers haven't changed. People often ask, you know, sociologists of the Jews, why do you keep talking about the growth of Orthodoxy? The numbers are identical, which they are. Over the last several studies, several decades, the numbers have remained about the proportion of the Jewish people that are Orthodox, according to the studies, it remains the same. So how can we speak of a growth of Orthodoxy? So there is more Orthodox commitment. It is stricter, and institutionally it's more important. It's no longer the case that the Jewish community is run by the liberals who tolerate the Orthodox and provide kosher food for them as a favor when they come. A number of years ago, I was serving on the Federation Communal Planning Committee. Federation has two big committees, communal planning and distribution. Communal planning decides in principle what ought to go up, what ought to go down, what should be supported, what shouldn't be supported. Distribution puts a dollar sign on it. You know, given what communal planning suggests in terms of general policy, this is the number of dollars. They look at the budgets and all that. We talk about the ideas. Once a year, there was a kind of seminar when we got together, spent a whole Sunday, the two committees together. I was on communal planning, and I remember overhearing a conversation between two members of the distribution committee, both wearing kippot, at the buffet table. One, as I came by, one of them said to the other, you know, you should have fought harder for this at that last meeting. I don't even know what he was fighting for at the last meeting. But the other one answered, I don't have to. And he said, why not? He said, I'll tell you why not. He said, they know on that committee that when I retire from the committee, my children will succeed me here. They also know that when they retire from that committee, my children will succeed them here. And that's what's happening. That's what's happening. Last time I was in Yerushalayim, I ran into the guy who was head of the Reform Movement for many, many years. He really built that whole beautiful complex for the Reform Movement next to the King David Hotel. And he was looking very worried. He told me he had just come out of a meeting with a woman whose family foundation had paid for most of that. And she said to him, I have to warn you, there isn't going to be that much money in the future because we have given our children more control of the foundation and they have different interests. In Jewish philanthropic life generally, that's an old story. Federations around the country know that. As the new generation comes in, they're philanthropic, they still give the money away, but they're not giving it to Jewish causes. Except in the Orthodox community. In the Orthodox community, they're continuing to give it to the Jewish causes. On top of that, there were certain identity changes among Jews that have implications, again, for the growth of Orthodoxy and of its movement to the right. I think the basic change in all of Jewish histories was from one kind of Jewish identity to another, a kind of pre-enlightenment, pre-emancipation Jewish identity to a post-enlightenment, post-emancipation, or what we call modern Jewish identity. We all know modern Jews. Now, by the way, I'm talking about mostly not you and me, but the mode, the average Jew that you run into. Compare him with the one pre-emancipation Jew you all know, Tevye. Now, granted, Tevye is over-romanticized, but he was really the classical kind of Jew. For Tevye, he was a Jew because he was part of the Jewish community. Community came first. And that's the way it was until, in the United States, maybe 50, 60 years ago for Jews. The modern or post-emancipation Jewish identity is an individual characteristic. An individual is a Jew. The Jewish community is simply a name we give when a lot of Jews do something together. But one starts out as a Jew, and then one joins, to the extent he wants to, the Jewish community and its various organizations and institutions. That's a different kind of identity. Tevye didn't start out as a Jew and then join the Jewish community. Tevye started out as a Jewish community. Since he was in the Jewish community, he was a Jew. That's a big difference. Difference number two. Today, when you conceptualize what it is to be a Jew, you talk about roles. Everybody has many roles. Sociologists love that term. You're a husband, you're a father, you're a golfer, you're a lawyer, you're a New Yorker, you're a Republican, you're a this, you're a that, and you're a Jew. Being Jewish is one of your roles. That's how it's conceptualized. Is Jewishness one of Tevye's roles? No. Tevye was also a husband and a father and then on a tefkite and a dairyman and whatever he was. Being Jewish wasn't one of Tevye's roles. Being Jewish was the way Tevye played all of his roles. It was a total identity. Today, increasingly, it's a fragment. It's a part of life. It's not everything we do. For Tevye, Jewishness was the most important fact about him. Had Tevye been a butcher instead of a dairyman, he'd be the same man. If he had sons instead of daughters, he'd be the same man. If he were rich instead of poor, he tells us what he'd be like. He's basically Tevye, only this way he'd be Tevye with money instead of Tevye without money. If Tevye weren't Jewish, you wouldn't recognize him. You wouldn't know him. Somebody once quipped that an anthropologist could follow most Jews around for 3 months before figuring out they were Jewish. That's a sad joke. But it's true. Tevye had a sense that he was different, basically fundamentally different from the non-Jews in Anatevka. Most contemporary Jews don't have that sense of distinctiveness. But basically we're all alike. I mean, there are differences of poetry, there are differences of idiom, the music is a little different, they have their holidays, we have our holidays, even if the holidays are a little different. Basically there is a sense of similarity. I mean, there are all kinds of people in the population, but we're all part of the same overall unity. That becomes the psychological feeling, rather than the sense of if you're a Jew, you're distinctive, your basic location is in the Jewish people and Jewish history.
What's the difference between the way the Jew you're describing and, say, the Jew pre-World War II Germany type of image?
It's going to sound like a cop-out, but I'm going to be academically precise. I don't know. I've studied American Jewry. I have not studied the Jewry of... I mean, I know a little about the history. So do you. We all do. I don't want to answer with the kind of additional understanding of the data and the inner dynamics that I don't have. I'm sorry.
It just means...
Of course.
Yeah.
Look, any two situations, there are certain similarities and certain differences. I just cannot say. There's another interesting and very subtle and important difference. Look, if I wanted to introduce two guys, George and Henry, let us say, I'm going to say to them, George and Henry, I'm about to introduce you. In our culture, when two people are introduced, they shake hands. as you know. George and Henry, will each of you please raise his hand? George, this is Henry. Henry, this is George. Gentlemen, shake hands. You may now drop your hands. George and Henry, I hope you will really enjoy knowing each other and maybe even become very good friends. If I did that, you'd think I were in a Woody Allen movie. I mean, we just don't do that, right? Shall I tell you what happens in most schools on Sukkot? My friends, today is Sukkot. On Sukkot, we take a lulav and an etrog. That is, if you haven't left everything to the surrogate in front. Please take your lulav in your right hand, your etrog in your left hand, with a pitum pointing down. Open your siddur to page 358, count four lines up from the bottom, and say with me, which the congregation then does. Good. Now, turn your etrog with the pitum pointing up and give him a good shake. That's what happens in most shuls, right? Now, what's the difference? The difference is whether it's internalized or alien. Do you know why I wouldn't do that with George and Henry? Because I don't have to. It's their culture. That's the way we do things. You introduce George to Henry, the guys shake hands. You don't have to tell him. You don't have to instruct him. You don't have to tell him how to do it. You don't have to say how long it should take. You don't have to say how close they should stand. You don't have to tell him anything. It's their culture. The point is that most Jews in America, even what they kept, they lost. If you have to, children, you have to tell how to do your culture. Adults, by definition, you don't. If you have to tell an adult how to do it, it is by definition not his culture. Would Tevye's Rav have done that? Of course not. Had he done it, they would have assumed he had started his Simchas Torah drinking a week early. No way. In fact, the more traditional the setting, the fewer directions the congregation gets. It's almost a straight measure. The fewer directions you give the congregation, the more traditional the congregation is. Because it's more internalized. It's done more often. It's done with a greater sense of involved, internalized familiarity, rather than a sense of distance and alienation. Now, where does it all lead, this kind of new Jewish identity? First, to a kind of intellectual incoherence. We say to our children, Jewishness is very important, and it should take over all your life. We don't really say that, by the way. What we say to them is that you should say, and you should love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. But remember, your music lessons are also important. You don't miss the baseball game. And you really shouldn't cut that class on Yantif because the professor may say something you need for the exam. But you should love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. There is a contradiction in that. God chose the Jewish people and gave them a special historic role at Sinai through which, if they do it correctly, the world will be redeemed. Nothing less than that. But we're really not different from anybody else on the face of the earth, except in some minor details. Those two statements don't go together. Now, our kids are Jewish kids. They're smart. And at some level or another, they understand that there is incoherence, intellectual incoherence. More than that, the Jewishness that we give them, though we want them to feel it, is hollow. It's hollow emotionally. Let me explain why. You've heard the phrase, often, we are often urged by our educators and our rabbis to express our Jewishness. You've heard that? You should express your Jewishness. You get your kids to express their Jewishness. What that means is take time off from life, step back somehow, and express Jewishness. I suggest to you that that's devastating. Let me be autobiographical. Because a couple of things happened in my life that made me understand this principle. A number of years ago, when my oldest daughter, now, thank God, the mother of two lovely children, when she was 5 years old, I got a call one Motzei Shabbat from my friend, the president of the shul. Rosh Hashanah started the next night, Sunday night. Bert said to me, Mervin, we need you. I said, yeah, what is it? He said, our Baal Tokea has a bad throat. The doctor says there's no way he's blowing shofar. Can you do it? I know you have a shofar. He had seen it in my house. I said, yes, I do own a shofar, but I have to tell you, Bert, I never learned how to blow it. Bert's answer was a classic. He said, "You have 23 hours. I'm not going to take any more of your very valuable time." And hung up. So I don't know how to blow shofar in one day. I was getting advice from everybody who might be able to do it. My in-laws were spending Rosh Hashanah with us. They came Sunday morning, and I'm trying to get sound out of this thing. It's already almost noon, and I am not succeeding. Just got tired. I put it down. My 5-year-old Shira picked it up, put it to her lips, and blew it to Kia that was gorgeous. And needless to say, her grandparents made all the fuss you would expect grandparents to make in a situation like that. Number two. The Rebbeinu Shalom wanted the Jews to hear shofar that year, so about 3 hours or so before Rosh Hashanah, I finally got the hang of it. The next morning in shul, I was acutely aware that my children were different from the others. I mean, all the kids sort of gather. I won't daven in a synagogue where they exclude children. It's, you know, they were all gathering around and, you know, the bima up front and looking and whatever. I was acutely aware that for my children it was different because it was their Abba doing it. 2 weeks later, there was a terrible storm in New York. And so on the third day of Sukkot, I was trying to rebuild the half of the Sukkah that collapsed. And daughter number 2, 4 years old, was helping me. You know how helpful it is to have a 4-year-old running around with a hammer. But she was helping me. Last event. When my son got to a certain point, whenever I went to Israel and came back with a new supply of chutz l'gog, Ronen got to them first. And I got the leftovers. So I had to make a deal with him. I can wear his, he can wear mine. That way I got to wear the nice one sometimes. Question. Was I giving my children Jewish experiences? Psychological answer, no. They were children's experiences. For Shira, it was that wonderful experience that children get the first time they stay up on a bike, the first time they make it across a pool on their own. It was an experience of growth, of accomplishment, and just the way their grandparents are going to get all giddy the first time they stay up on a bike and the first time they make it across the pool on their own, their grandparents got giddy when she got sound out of a shofar. That's a normal child's experience that sinks deep into the psyche. When my kids were standing there and I was blowing shofar, they don't understand. They were 5 years old and 4 years old. You think they knew philosophy at that point? For them, it was a my dad's a hero experience. I will never hit the winning home run, ever. I mean, I'm an athletic moron. But that day, my kids had a that's my dad the hero experience. Because they didn't understand anything of a philosophy. They knew one thing. I was the focus of attention. I was standing there in the middle making an awful lot of noise. Everybody was paying close attention. It was important to a synagogue full of people. They didn't know why. But I was the center of attention. I was the star. And for them, that's my dad, the hero up there. That's what it was. They didn't understand the Jewish stuff. When Adina was helping me rebuild the Sukkah, you think she knew the philosophy of Sukkah? The kid had just turned 4. But for her, that was helping Dad do something that he needs. Not helping me blow up a balloon for my party. Balloons are cute, but they're really silly, and even a 4-year-old knows that. But Dad needs that. He's doing it for him. And I'm helping. I'm helping my father do something that he, as an adult, needs for himself. That's being useful. That's making a contribution. And for my son, it was a sharing clothes with Dad experience. When the girls got old enough, my wife couldn't keep anything in her closet. If she really wanted anything nice, she had to buy 2 of them. The only question was which of the girls would make off with the other one. For a child growing up, when you get to the point where you can share clothes with a parent, that's a certain stage in life. My daughters assured me that my son would never share anything but kippot because his taste is too good, and they're absolutely right. So it turned out, he's now bigger than I am, but for him, that wasn't something I was giving him Jewish. That was at least a kippotah for Abba and me. What am I saying? if one takes time off from life and creates artificial occasions that are set aside for the expression of Jewishness, they may be beautiful, but emotionally they have nothing to latch on to. If they are part of everyday life, part of the process of growing up, if they are children's things, worked into the very core of being and growing, then they have the emotional resonance to matter. So that generation grew up the way described, but they produced in their children was emotionally hollow as well as intellectually incoherent. Now, clearly, the more to the right you go in Jewish life, the more you see Jewishness as a community. Orthodoxy is the one part of the Jewish community that requires community, one part of the Jewish people that requires community. There can be no Orthodox life without a synagogue, without a school, without a mikveh, without kosher butchers, without kosher bakeries, without all of the institutions, and there have to be enough Jews around there to support them all. That is, the more to the right you move, the more Jewishness is going to be part of a community, not just individuals. The more it's going to be total. It's going to be all day, every day. It's going to touch on every aspect of life. The more it will be first. That, by the way, I suggest is really the difference between a religious and a secular perspective. From a religious perspective, religion comes first. It has to, because God is God. You don't fit religion into other things. That's a contradiction in terms. From a religious perspective, even if you're a liberal, so you see it liberally, but religion has to come first. In a secular perspective, religion may be beautiful, it may be inspiring, it may be lovely, the way concerts are, the way theaters are, the way museums are, but they don't come first. They enrich life. They don't frame life, shape life, inform life, direct life. That's a secular perspective. The religion is beautiful, it's secondary. From a religious perspective, religion has to be primary. That's not because one is a fanatic, it's because of the inherent logic of religion. If religion flows, has something to do with God, and God is ultimate, nothing can supersede that, nothing can trump it. So, religion is primary, Jewishness is primary, again, the more to the right you go. Distinct and non-distinct. Again, if Jewishness is distinctive, that moves us more and more to the right. The more to the left you are, the less difference you see between Jewishness and the surrounding culture. And of course, the more to the right you are, the more internalized it becomes, the more it becomes sort of a reflex, an instinct. Now, most kids, I think, understand, however little we teach them, that real Jewishness sits in community. The little that they know that. They know that it claims the total person. That it claims the total person at the top of the scale. That it makes Jews different. And that Jewish life, at its best, becomes reflexive. In other words, their implicit understanding is that religion on the right really is more authentic. In a psychological sense. In the sense of Jewish identity patterns. Now what we see now as a result of that are two things in Jewish life. One, correlations. We used to say 60, 80 years ago, in the 20s, 30s, that you could be Jewish many different ways. You could be a religious Jew, you could be a cultural Jew, you could be a social Jew, you could be a philanthropic Jew. Now, each Jew is Jewish in a different way. And people chose which way they wanted to be Jewish. Now, all the studies show the more of one, the more of another. The more observance of ritual, the more commitment or involvement in organizations, the more philanthropy, the closer the ties to Israel, the more education, the more. In fact, we call that the theory of the more. And every study for the last 20 years or so has shown that. Positive correlations, however you divide them up, the more religiously traditional people are, the more they are committed to Jewish secular kinds of norms. Organizational involvement, concern with the Jewish people, philanthropy, all of the so-called secular stuff is also related to traditional religious observance. And the second thing we see is a kind of polarization, a movement toward the extremes, toward more or toward less. Now, to the extent that continuity is an issue in Jewish life, will we survive, will there be Jewish continuity, to the extent that that becomes an issue, we ask, what works? How can we get the kids? This is now a big question in Jewish education and in the Jewish community. And again, all of the studies show certain answers. What seems correlated with future Jewish commitment? Day school education, Jewish camping, trips to Israel. Those are the three that come out on top. And these kinds of Shabbaton type programs. Those are the ones that seem to have the greatest impact. Now, my question is, what do they have in common? What they all have in common is a kind of wholeness and integration of Jewish life. It's not just a lesson here or an isolated experience there. Day school, you know, it's the whole thing. Camping, you literally leave and go to a different community, which is a total community. Shabbaton, those programs, it's not you come in and you go out. You have the whole Shabbat in all of its dimensions. You eat and you daven and you sing and you learn and you have friendships and it's integrated within a Jewish framework. And of course, a trip to Israel, you're in a Jewish environment. You're in a Jewish state. Even if it may not be traditional, you see the integration of it all. That's the common theme. The integration, the wholeness, the enthusiasm, the community. And that we see more on the right. Which is, again, another reason why there is a tendency increasingly to move right. The push from the left, as the decline, as Western culture declines and becomes less attractive, the fact that the right seems to have those characteristics that are of concern to Jews in terms of education of children, the wholeness, the completeness, the primacy, the totality, they seem to have more of it because there is less mixture in communities on the right than there are in modern Orthodox communities. What's our challenge, those of us who sit here? And I say our challenge, I'm not wearing a white shirt or a black suit. I went to and now teach at a university. What is our challenge? I think in part, one thing is to articulate an ideology, not of compromise, but of commitment. I find it historically intriguing, more than that. I find it significant that Jews have always lived at the center of the world. The land that Abraham was given was precisely in the middle of the two major empires of his day. Right in the middle. And it stayed there until the destruction of the Second Temple. Right in the, at the center of the world, in fact. And when the Jews have been in diasporas all over the world, that's where we always were. I mean, there were Jewish communities here and Jewish communities there, but the primary Jewish populations were always where history was being written. Look, life would have been easier had God given us Australia. I mean, they have a warm part, they have a cold part, it's surrounded by water, it's more easily defended, the world doesn't care about it. We could have lived happily and securely. But we were not given Australia. Neither at the beginning nor through all of our history. We were always in the middle of where history was being written. Whenever we moved from here to there, history's primary story moved with us. Now, if you believe there's a divine hand in history, that may mean something. It may be that our task is not only to be something internally, but to carry on a conversation. That building very high, thick walls and withdrawing from the rest of humanity, though these days it may be safer if we want to preserve what we are, may not be what we're supposed to do. may be exactly what we're not supposed to do. Now, if that can be the beginning of an ideology, the need to be part of the world, but to be part of the world with commitment, not a part of the world doing whatever the world says because that's what modern people are doing these days. Part of the world with a willingness to say no. No, even if it's pleasant, even if it's nice, even if it looks good. That, I think, is what modern orthodoxy at its best is. It's within the world, but it understands when to say no, based on halakha. If we develop that ideology and that mood and that style, I think we not only preserve an approach, but I think we strengthen the right approach. That means developing clear criteria of participation in the world. It means dealing with a notion of autonomy, because we live in a world of freedom and people are going to do what they're going to do. As somebody once said, there is no such thing as a traditional community anymore. Because when you say the phrase traditional community, what you really mean is a community that people are born into, and that's their life. Today everybody chooses. Today if you're if part of the traditional community, it's because you choose to be part of it. We all have choice. So you have to deal with notions of autonomy, again, within the context of commitment. And it seems to me one other thing. And I hope this doesn't sound like a drasha. We really have to be models. Because one thing seems clear. I mean, Joachim Vach said it once when Joachim Vach was, I guess, America's leading historian of religion. He was at the University of Chicago and still probably claimed to be the leading historian of religion in America. He once said, you know, religion is like a disease in that you can only catch it from somebody who already has it. In a largely secular culture, what will bring people close is modeling. I once quipped, I'm not the first one or the only one I think to have said it, that we will have a chance when they say in the street, oh, I didn't need to get it in writing, he told me and he wears a kippah. When they can say that in the street, then we'll prevail. You know, there's this wonderful story about Hillel and the pagan. I'm sure you all know it, but I'm going to tell it again anyhow. The pagan comes to Shammai and says, if you teach me your whole tradition while I stand on one foot, I'll become Jewish. So Shammai said, don't insult me in my tradition. He drove him away. He went to Hillel and said, if you teach me your whole tradition while I stand on one foot, I'll become Jewish. He said, okay, what's hateful to you, don't do to your fellow man. The rest is commentary. Now go learn. And the guy became a Jew. So there's a question. Let me ask you, if somebody gave you that answer, would it make you convert? Not me. I mean, it's lovely, it's beautiful, it's charming, but enough to make a man convert? No. What made him convert? Not the answer. The fact that Hillel gave the answer. Because what went through that pagan's mind was, look, I just addressed the leader of the Jewish people, their top leader. I insulted him. I know I insulted him. What do you mean, teach me old tradition while I stand on one foot? That's an insult. And what did this great figure do? Calmly and patiently, he pulled one very nice principle out of his tradition, gave me a beautiful and loving answer, was careful enough to say that's not the whole thing, and you really ought to learn more. But he met me on my terms. He gave me a loving and beautiful answer. You know something? The religion that can produce that kind of leader, that's for me. That's what happened. Not the answer itself. The fact that Hillel gave the answer. Now, Vach is right. When these kids go to camps and Israeli trips and all of that, it's not the scenery. It's not the lake. It's the fact that we put on the staff, counselors and visitors, that dress it up. I mean, I used to do that. Before I moved across the street to teach at the university, I was working in Hillel, and we used to stage those things, and we made sure that the kids saw the enthusiasm. and saw the learning and saw the singing and had people they could say, gee, look at this guy. Look at what Shabbat means to him. That's great. And they would try to do it. Now, that's the other thing we have to do. If we can show that modern orthodoxy, I don't care whether modern orthodoxy is the right word or not, you know what I mean by it. If we can show that that segment of the Jewish people has the full commitment, the ability to participate in the larger culture and the larger society with Jewish standards, and to do it in a way that conveys Jewishness and Judaism at its very best, at its very best, then I think we'll prevail. I think we'll prevail for the sociological reasons I've given. Because in a free society, in a society in which you're not bound by the community into which you're born, in a society in which you can pick and choose whether or not you should, you can, and nobody can force you to do anything, the only thing that will win people over is their seeing that it is really so much better, so much more beautiful, so much finer than the alternatives. And they will see that not if we tell them, because everybody tells them, if they see it really work. That really isn't a grusha. It's the only thing that will work in a free world. It so happens that that's also what the rabbis tell us is the way in which we will fail or succeed. If we live up to that, yes, we will thrive. In this connection, my favorite Midrashic comment is that, of course, Avraham is told that his descendants will be as numerous as the stars in the heavens and the sand on the seashore. And the rabbis ask, why those two metaphors or similes? And they say, because if the Jews don't live up to their covenant, their challenge, they're like sands on the seashore, insignificant, to be walked on, who cares? If the Jews do live up to the challenge of their covenant, then they're like stars in the heavens. Remember, in a world without electricity, they give you direction in the darkness of night. That's what we agreed to be. And I find it not the least bit surprising that the end of what I hope is a reasonable sociological analysis comes to precisely the same conclusion as to what we need to do, how we need to do it, and the benefits that we will enjoy for having done it. Thank you.
A few minutes for some questions, if anybody.
Yeah.
I have a whole bunch of things to say.
Okay.
A lot of things I hopefully blithely take issue with. First, I was a little bit upset about the sweeping characterization of the whole non-Jewish or the secular world as just freedom-loving, if it feels good to do it.
Okay. Before you go on, can I respond to that? I try to tell my students, at least in introductory courses, that the first rule of sociology is everybody has a cousin who's different. It was a sweeping generalization in one sense, not another sense. I wasn't saying that everybody and everything is like it. I could not make such a statement, obviously. The thrust is changing. The primary emphases, I think, are there. And I think I'm correct in talking about the mode, the dominant pattern. Obviously, not everybody falls under that.
Okay, I understand that. But I kind of feel like everybody's walking around following Britney Spears as the model of secular civilization, when I also know very much, especially in the past few months, that Saul Bellow is a model of a secular thing, is a model of Jewish, is another kind of Jew that's a model for us.
Would you care to do a survey on the comparative actual influence on the way kids live of Britney Spears and Saul Bellow?
I'm just saying that that the whole world is not a Britney Spears world.
Okay.
That the secular world is not just a vast wasteland. Okay. I know there are 179 terrible channels on there. There are also some wonderful things on certain stations at certain times on television.
Okay.
There are wonderful things.
A little. I'll grant that. A little. I'll grant that.
On the internet, there's Divrei Torah on the internet.
Yep.
And there's pornography on the internet.
Right.
It's part of our job is to be judicious about it. The reason I bring up Saul Bellow, and I also want to bring up Arthur Miller, is because I have read a lot of very hostile things coming from the religious Jewish community about some of the prominent Jews who we would consider secular. And I am pained by that, and I feel that Kalal Yisrael is Kalal Yisrael.
Yeah. Look, I'll get back to you. We take one at a time.
Okay.
Look, in Israel this happens too. Look, compare, on the one hand, David Ben-Gurion and Rav Kook with what's going on today. What's going on today is that even traditional people, Dati people, are getting furious at the Haredi community. And the Haredim and at least some of the secularists are at each other's throats. Now, Ben-Gurion was as secular a guy as you were going to get. But you should see his library. I don't know if you did. And Rav Kook was Rav Kook. But he appreciated what secular Jews were contributing to Jewish history. That was a different world. It's very hard on both sides now to find that kind of reason and depth of understanding. For a whole bunch of reasons.
I'm having trouble understanding why there is that.
Why? Okay, several.
I also wanted to point out that the people who started the land of Israel and who insisted that it be a Jewish state and who insisted that the language be Hebrew and not Yiddish and not Russian and not French and not English were socialist, communist, atheistic Jews.
Right.
And they were the people that God said must have apparently
said,
you go, Lech Lecha, and go there and start my land again, even though you're atheist, even though you're communist.
Right.
Even though, so why don't we love these people anymore? What is happening to the Jewish right and the Jewish left that we don't have that bond anymore?
I'm First, there used to be fuller and deeper personal ties. In that members of one's family used to find the same family on both sides of the line. You also, in the old days, everybody who went to Israel went out of some Jewish motive, one Jewish motive or another, either to build the Jewish homeland or to help to observe the mitzvot that you're allowed to do only ba'aretz, or because they really believed that this was the possibility of reshit smichat gulateinu, or because they wanted to build Jewish secular society, and they felt that in the diaspora communities you couldn't do that, that you could really be secular was in a Jewish cultural place, or because they were escaping from somewhere. As Jews, they had to get out, or they were pushed out, and this was the place where, as Jews, they were taken. One way or another, they came because they were Jews. And they tended to have enough of a sense of Jewishness to know that even if they were opposing something, it was part of that overall Jewishness. Then you have a generation now that was just born there. They didn't get there out of Jewishness. They just happened to be born there. For some that matters, for some that doesn't matter. But it's a totally different perspective. They are not there because they're Jews. They didn't come out of some kind of Jewish motive and some kind of participation in Jewish history. They just happened to be born there. Second part of it. Americanization is all over the place. I mean, the imperial American culture sort of seeps into everything. It began to get worse, especially in the mid-80s. And we all have our favorite examples of Americanization. Everything from Atara, no longer being on that wonderful corner, instead Burger King, the funny one, to more significant and substantial ones. One day when I was in Israel, I finished my day's work. I sat down in the hotel, picked up the newspaper, and read about Sam Sheinbein, this kid from Maryland who did a murder and got on the plane to Israel. I said, will they extradite him? Won't they extradite him? It was a whole big business. And I read the article, and it said, the young man from America who, there was a parenthetical note, Israeli law precludes us from giving his name. He was a minor, and they couldn't bother to go on and on. Put down my newspaper, turned on my television, and I saw and heard about Sam Sheinbein being led into an Israeli court. His face, his name, everything. Now, we all have our examples of the Americanization of Israel in style and mood. I mean, last time I went to an Israeli thing, every tie was on an Israeli neck. The Americans dressed for Israel, the Israelis dressed up. Silly ones, big ones, important ones. Now, one of them is the notion that in a proper democracy, you don't have religion in the public arena. You have absolute, total religious discretion, and the state shouldn't touch religion. Now, especially among younger and among more Americanized, that sort of grows. Ben-Gurion wouldn't think of that. His question was, how do you have religion be part of the state, and at the same time you give people freedom to do what they want to do? The notion of separation would have stunned him and that whole generation. They did surveys. They rejected that notion. Increasingly, people accept the notion. Part of the American way is you separate all of that, and that idea sort of seeps in, and therefore the notion that the religious, provide a necessary anchor for something that should be part of the Jewish state, declines in its acceptance, over every several year period, to the point where many people on the far left in that regard, I mean, they've come up with a new term now. The terms used to be, of course, Haredi, Dati, Mesorati, and Chiloni. Chiloni meant you were not religious. Now, at the bottom of that, there's anti-Dati. It's only 5 to 7% of the population, anti-Dati, but they're very loud. They're the people who publish and the people who broadcast and the people who run into court every day. And it's growing, in part because you have a population starting to grow up, in part because of American influence, in part because of the next generation of secularization. People used to say, Jewishness doesn't have to be religious. It can be cultural, it can be all those things. That's what was said by the generation that wanted to do it. Our studies all show that it lasts for a generation and a half. After that, people go out. Now, what happens when an American Jew goes out the other end? He disappears. He leaves the community. He just stops being Jewish. What happens when an Israeli goes out the other end? He tries to take the country with him, because he can't just stop. So in America, when that happens to a Jew, that's what we refer to as the erosion from the community, the drop-off from the community. When that same phenomenon happens in Israel, to Jewish identity, they don't just disappear, they try to take the system with them. And so you have the anti-Datim, who are broadcasting and in courts and so on. Now, at the other end, the religious establishment respond, again, they build the walls higher and thicker for the reasons I've given, and are less willing to participate in the kinds of exchanges. Those who are willing are afraid that they will be discredited. There are some who understand that, but it's so easy to discredit them. And in that small, enclosed world, you hesitate to suffer that difficulty. Now, what's needed, in a sense, is those leaders, those rabbis who have the standing to be willing to do that, one would hope will come to the point where they are willing to risk, in the halachic, take their risks in the halachic community, and the balabatim, the lay leaders, have to support them top to bottom, if you find a few who are willing to do that. And so you have that pulling, to the two sides. You used to make more compromises. The compromises were easier in Israel to make. They were inconsistent. They made absolutely no sense. What, the buses won't run in Jerusalem, they will run in Haifa. Tel Aviv, they won't run except where they do run. Everybody knows that to grow pigs and to import pork is against the law, but everybody wants to buy it and knew where to find it. One after another like that. You think that the traditionalists wouldn't want to turn off the television on Shabbat, but they know they can turn off the television on Shabbat. So El Al, as long as it was owned by the state, it didn't fly. But the airport was open. Who owned the airport? So how do you come up with such illogic? You come up with such illogic because in a state where you have secularists and religious, and you want the state somehow to have both, you don't want either to win totally. You want to balance it. And so everybody gives a little bit. Now, as long as the secularists understand the value of traditional religion, they can say, it's not for me, but I understand the value of it. And as long as the religious are prepared to say, gee, I wish these people were more observant, but at least they're Jews building a state, you can make those deals. Once the secularist stops saying, it may not be for me, but I understand it, and starts saying, it's nonsense, and once the religious starts saying, not, you know, I wish they were observant Jews, but at least they're building a Jewish state, and said they're sinners, the conversation, you know, and there's more of it and more of it. How to get that reversed is very difficult, is very difficult. You really need great leadership on both sides.
And isn't it dangerous? I just see it as a very perulous time, because you see this...
It is a very perulous time.
This separation and this...
Should I share another thought with you?
Please.
I wish this thing were off. Maybe. Well, this is something I can say only in shul. I can't say in most lectures.